Robert Rogers, and you have just connected with Parkinson's Recovery, the place to come, the place to be able to get information that can help you get sustained relief from whatever symptoms you might be currently experiencing that are associated with a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. My guest today is Dr. Joseph Hickey, who is born and raised in Peekskill, New York. Dr. Hickey graduated from the University of Notre Dame. He is a graduate of the New York Medical College, and his residency was completed at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. In 2004, Dr. Hickey opened the Hickey Wellness Center, which is a primary care internal medicine facility in the incredible location of Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. In addition to providing primary care, Dr. Hickey is currently doing clinical research on various conditions, including fibromyalgia, multiple sclerosis, and, hold on to your seats, Parkinson's disease. Dr. Hickey, thanks so much for being with us today on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Robert. I'm looking forward to it.
So tell us about yourself.
Well, you've said most of it. I was born and raised in New York, practiced in New York for about 15 years, was a clinical instructor of internal medicine at New York Medical College, my alma mater, and tried to teach younger doctors, you know, how not to kill anybody, how to properly administer and take histories and physicals. And my area that I loved the most was history and physical and diagnostic skills. And around 1994, I moved to Hilton Head, basically to escape the weather from New York. And really, a lot of changes occurred when I reached Hilton Head. It was somewhat of a freer environment for me, you know, away from family and friends. I was able to expand a little bit. I started to most of what an internist does, and I'm a board-certified internist, most of what an internist does is take care of heart disease and cancer and diabetes, and that occupied most of my time for a good 10 years. And I basically found that carbohydrates or glucose ingestion was the major cause of coronary disease. You know, we've been taught for years that coronary disease or heart disease and artery disease is related to cholesterol and cholesterol ingestion, but it's really not so. You really don't develop heart disease from ingesting cholesterol. You develop heart disease from having insulin resistance. So I studied that for about 10 years and eventually did a research paper with Dr. Eric Westman from Duke University, using the Atkins diet to reduce heart disease risk factors. And what we did was we measured something very specific to heart disease, something called lipoprotein subclasses. So, you know, you get your LDL cholesterol measured and your total cholesterol measured, and you figure if it's under the goal of the National Cholesterol Education Panel, you're okay. But that's not true. Clearly, 30 to 40% of people who have a heart attack or die from a heart attack have LDL cholesterol supposedly to the goal of the National Cholesterol Education Panel. So I tried to explain why. What is it about those people that caused a heart attack despite, you know, my having told them that they didn't have anything to worry about after the physical? And it turns out that there's something new you could measure. There's something more you could measure. And it's called lipoprotein subclasses, which looks at the size of the LDL particle. And the smaller the LDL cholesterol particle is, the more likely it's going to penetrate the artery wall and the more of them you need. So that was my first sort of step away from the box, so to speak. Using the Atkins diet in people with heart disease was considered absolutely crazy. But Dr. Atkins felt that was necessary because of carbohydrates' potential to turn into fat. So very briefly, if you have insulin resistance, meaning diabetic, but most people are well on the way to that before they are defined as a diabetic. Those people, when they eat carbohydrates, really can't transfer them from the blood into their cells, because insulin is the hormone that does that. You're insulin resistant. It creates a backup of glucose in your blood, and your liver will then convert that glucose into cholesterol, and you become this cholesterol-producing factory. So I was restricting carbohydrates in my heart disease patients. Mind you, these were people who were on cholesterol-lowering drugs and were still having recurrent heart attacks and had LDL cholesterols to the goal of the National Cholesterol Education Panel. So I found that they were still at great risk because of the size of the LDL particle, and when I restricted carbohydrates, we were able to reverse that trend. And so we published a paper in 2003 together in a journal called The Metabolic Syndrome. And it was around that time that I learned how to properly measure toxic metals, around 2003. So I had been avidly studying heart disease prevention with the lower carbohydrate diet, but it was around that time that a family member got very sick and was told that he had a diagnosis that would probably give him a prognosis of 6 to 8 months and he should get his affairs in order. And he called me and said, "Can you help me, Doc?" And I said, "Well, come down and let's see what we can figure out." And it turned out he had lead toxicity. And, that led to my discovering that we really aren't measuring toxic metals properly. And it led to a lot of investigation that uncovered a lot of very interesting things that showed me that neurotoxic metals contribute to many neurodegenerative disorders. So it was quite a revelation. If I may, I'll expound on that a little bit. A cousin of mine was given a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a degenerative and almost universally fatal condition of the bone marrow, where he couldn't make blood. And he was seen at two bone marrow transplant centers, one in Boston, one in New York, and another down here in South Carolina, where I got a third opinion. And his bone marrow just couldn't produce blood. So, just reviewing his history, he was a plumber and he worked for a nuclear power plant. And that was my only clue, that he was a plumber, and plumbers deal with lead pipes. And I said, "Well, John, I know that lead toxicity can create anemia, and you have a severe anemia. Have you been exposed to lead?" And he said, "Yeah, Doc, I had removed several lead pipes from this one facility in New York, and that was a year before he got sick." So I said, "Well, if you have lead toxicity, then there's something called chelation," which I had never used. I'd never even thought of using, didn't know how to use 10 years ago. But I said, "There's this treatment called chelation that could remove the lead, and maybe that's the only thing you could have that I could help you with." And so he got excited, I got excited. But the traditional measurement that I was taught for lead toxicity was to a blood lead level and to do a 24-hour urine collection for heavy metals. And he had very little lead in his blood. He only had 3 micrograms, and the average person has up to 10. And he had very little excretion from the 24-hour urine. So I got very disappointed and said, "Well, John, I don't think you have lead toxicity." And, of course, he was already psyched up to be chelated. And chelation, dates back to FDA-approved EDTA chelation was 1951. Now, I had never thought to chelate a person for heavy metal toxicity because I've never found an elevated blood lead level. And so I assumed that meant they weren't exposed to it. But with John, he begged me to chelate him anyway. And, he said, "Look, I have nothing else I can do. I'm sure that I've had a lot of lead exposure. I don't know why it's in the blood." So I started to chelate him. I learned how to do it. I started to chelate him, and within about 6 weeks, his bone marrow function returned to normal. So a light bulb went off in my head, we're measuring this wrong. There's got to be another way to measure it. And that led to some very interesting investigations. And that's what got me started on this. And then I started testing in the proper way neurotoxic metals. And they are so commonly present in Parkinson's disease and in Alzheimer's disease and in MS. The levels are ubiquitous in those diseases. So I started to remove them to see what would happen, and I started getting some clinical responses, and that's really how I started out 10 years ago.
What specifically was it that led you to suspect a connection between the symptoms of Parkinson's disease and heavy metals?
Well, my neurology my neurology consults would always include a heavy metal analysis. So whenever I would send someone to one of my colleagues in neurology who had a neurologic disorder, they would always do a heavy metal screen. So, and that was particularly true for peripheral neuropathy, and really for any neurodegenerative disorder, you have to consider lead and mercury, cadmium toxicity, aluminum toxicity. These are definite causes of neurodegeneration. We should go through some of the literature connecting those disorders and what those metals do to brain function. But that was always included as almost a routine screen. And the way we would screen for it, and the way that most neurologists, if they even think of it, currently screen for it, is to do a blood lead and mercury level, blood aluminum level, and a 24-hour urine collection. But in 20 years of screening people for those metals, I never found an elevated level. Now, that means one of two things. Number one, that no one has toxicity from these metals and that we've kept the environment relatively pure of them. Because if it's in the environment, it's in us. We eat the food that comes out of the ground. We breathe the air. We breathe the dust that is in the ground. Most of us grew up during the era of leaded gasoline. So when you put lead into gasoline, tetraethyl lead came out of everybody's exhaust pipe, and we inhaled it. And lead and mercury are so similar in their chemical structure and positive charge to calcium, zinc, and magnesium that they are directed right into the bone and muscle and cells, just like calcium would be. So they're automatically attracted into the tissues. And that's why you don't find them in the blood, because they disappear within hours to days after exposure, and most of it are attracted into bone. So really, I started out very innocently with the idea, well, I know that mercury and lead are toxic to the nervous system, and now that I know how to measure it, now that I know how to tell what's in my particular patient, what would happen if I remove them? And that, I would see a clinical response. I would see an improvement in energy first. I would see an improvement in cognitive function. Parkinson's patients constantly fall asleep, and everything slows down. Their thinking slows down. Their movement slows down. And that's electrical speed. Electrical speed is positive and negative charges being separated. So, that's the way your neuron works. Your cell membrane is negatively charged. Calcium, zinc, magnesium, sodium, potassium, they're positively charged metals. And you have these little pumps on the cell membranes that separate the positive charge from the cell membrane, and that creates a tension because they positive charges want to meet a negative charge. They want to come together. So these cell membranes generate electricity by basically separating sodium and potassium and calcium from the cell membrane with sodium, potassium, calcium pumps. And that separation of the positive charge from the negative charge actually creates an electrical spark, and that's what a neuronal depolarization is. So I started to think in these terms that, well, what if you have the wrong positive charges? What if you have lead instead of sodium, or lead instead of calcium? And it led me to research what other researchers have talked about, and it basically explained it explained how a neuron can dysfunction, how a neuron or a neuronal mitochondria might fall apart, what would happen if the mitochondria fell apart, what then happens what kind of oxidative stresses occur within the neuron. And, you know, all this was basically explained by neuroscientists. So the key was I learned how to measure it. And the second thing was I was curious to see if they were present, if these metals, these toxic metals, were present in my patients with idiopathic Parkinson's disease, idiopathic Alzheimer's disease, and lo and behold, I found very high levels of mercury, particularly, and lead in those patients. Almost always, that combination of mercury and lead are found in my Parkinson's patients. And so I started to remove it to see what would happen. And, you know, I saw significant improvements in some of the clinical parameters, particularly in the cognitive function, in the alertness, in the speed of movement. And what's also very interesting is that I started to see that I was able to lower the dose of their medications. You know, there's no question that Sinemet and levodopa will help the symptoms of a Parkinson's patients, but that is a relatively short-lived period of time, 5-6 years, and then they start getting further reductions in dopamine production. You have to increase the doses, and then you start seeing the side effects like dyskinesia. And I was able to see an ability to lower the Sinemet dose and improve the dyskinesia and improve some of the other symptoms like psychosis. If you can give less medicine, and I really tried to explain what I was doing, what I was seeing with some of the neuroscience. You know, why would I be able to lower the medication? Well, one of the reasons is probably they're able to produce some of their own dopamine. That these neurotoxic metals, if they disable the mitochondria of the neurons in the midbrain, that they can reduce the production. And some of these metals you can attract out of the cell, and that would improve the mitochondrial function. So, you know, basically, just by trial and error, by looking to see what was in the patient, by using the FDA-approved treatment to remove those metals, chelation, I was able to see some clinical responses.
I am quite sure that a number of the listeners right now have probably had the test that you mentioned. They've had a blood test, they've had a urine analysis, and they've been told that they do not have any heavy metals in their body. You're saying that's not really going to reveal whether or not those heavy metals are there. So what is the best way to measure neurotoxic metals?
Right. And that's well established in the occupational health and environmental health literature. It's not necessarily established in the general medical literature. So I'm a normally trained doctor, board certified internist. I knew nothing about any of this literature. I was taught to measure it as a blood test and as a 24-hour urine collection. But when you look at some of the literature, when I went all the way back to 1950, 1960, in the 60s, the 70s, and the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was a tremendous amount of research on heavy metal toxicity because of, you know, the pollution that we were dealing with. We had no thought about how toxic these metals were, even though we should have. I mean, there's hundreds of years of information on lead poisoning and mercury poisoning throughout the literature, but we put lead into gasoline, we put lead into paint, so people who worked in those factories got very sick. And, you know, battery factories, paint factories, people working in the petroleum industry got very, very sick. And because they were working every single day with lead or with other toxic metals, it was obvious why they got sick. Their blood lead level was high because they were exposed to it on a daily basis. When researchers would remove them from a factory, when doctors would remove them from a factory because their lead level was extremely high in the blood, because your blood level is going to tell you what you were exposed to within the past few days. And within days, it's going to be attracted into your bone or into your muscles or into your other cells. so it disappears from the blood. And researchers found that in the 60s and 70s that if you remove those patients from the industrial source of say lead poisoning, for instance, that the lead would eventually disappear from the blood, but the patient didn't get better, and they would measure what was being excreted, and very little amounts were being excreted. So the conclusion was, well, these people are retaining the lead. Where are they retaining it? And biopsy studies then sought the source of, you know, where the lead was going, and most of it goes into bone. So 90%. So when you take a calcium pill, you expect it to help fortify your bones. Well, how does it know to go into the bone? Well, it does. You know, the good Lord set it up properly. Your bones are made out of protein, and plenty of protein. And protein is negatively charged. And calcium, zinc, and magnesium are positively charged. 2 plus positively charged calcium will be attracted into the negatively charged protein of your bone. So in the same fashion, lead and mercury and cadmium and aluminum are 2 plus positively charged, aluminum being 3 plus positively charged. They're going to be attracted into bone just like calcium will. So the researchers found that if you biopsy the bone and you analyze the bone, the majority of the lead went into the bone. And then that led to specific x-rays that could actually detect lead in bone. So there's an x-ray called K-shell x-ray fluorescence that was developed in the late 70s. And this is a special x-ray technique that can actually quantitate the lead content of your bone or the mercury content of your bone. So that led to the capability of studying it. So if you did an x-ray of this bone, and this x-ray is not widely available, it's available at research centers. There's a researcher at University of Michigan, Howard Hugh, who does a lot of x-ray fluorescence studies with lead, and there are people at Harvard who do it, and so there's 3 or 4 places around the country where you can get this x-ray, and this x-ray can quantitate how much lead's in your shin bone, for instance. And if you can quantitate how much lead and mercury is in the shin bone as opposed to calcium, and you watch those populations of people, you can see that those with the higher lead levels in their shin bone versus the lower lead levels get more neurodegenerative diseases. They get more dementia. They get more brain breakdown. They get more coronary disease. And these studies, there's several beautiful studies correlating lead and mercury content of bones. So the researchers showed that, well, these metals disappear from blood. And if they disappear from blood, they're not going to be excreted. So you're not going to find them in a blood test. You're not going to find them in a 24-hour urine collection. And that's the way they're screened by most doctors. And that's the way I screened for it until I discovered that there was a different way of measuring it. So in the early 80s, of course, several other interesting metals started to evolve, like cadmium and aluminum and mercury, things that we were using in industry that were being placed in the environment. And obviously, if they're in the environment, we're going to absorb them through our food source and through the air. So to try and get a better idea of how many different toxic metals were in bone and that were absorbed from the environment, a measurement was designed in 1983 called the EDTA where you would give a chelator. Now, a chelator is a negatively charged protein that's more negatively charged. It's not necessarily a protein, but it acts like a protein. It's a negatively charged substance that is more negatively charged than the protein of your bone. So now the lead in that bone wants to leave the bone and go on to a greater negative charge because of a greater magnetic attraction. So a chelator was actually designed in the early 40s, 1940s, because of arsine gas, which is a poison gas that the Germans were using on the British and French troops. They were basically putting arsenic into a bomb. They were exploding the bomb. The soldiers would inhale the arsenic gas, and they would drop dead. And the autopsy studies would show, well, they're dying of arsenic, and the British, French, and American doctors were, you know, basically perplexed as to what to do about this, and they called in the chemist and said, could you make a safe antidote for this, or we're all going to be speaking German soon. And they said, well, sure, we could. We could put a substance in the blood that would be more attractive to the arsenic than, say, the protein of the heart or the protein of the red blood cells. So they made the first human chelator called BAL, British anti-lewisite, and they would inject the soldiers, and that was an antidote for the arsenic. So as the arsenic was inhaled, it would be selectively attracted into the chelator. The chelator would bind it so that it couldn't interact with any other tissue, and then the kidney and liver would excrete it. So that was basically an antidote to arsine gas that occurred in 1941. And over the next decade, it was approved. Different chelators were improved by the FDA for lead poisoning and for mercury poisoning. And most of the clinical approaches to that were usually done in factory workers or people exposed at the workplace. So they had this steady exposure on a daily basis. So you would see it in the blood. But again, when you remove them from the factory, the levels of these metals would disappear. So researchers said, well, why don't we, if we take somebody out of a factory, and think of it in our case, we're not factory workers. We just grew up in America. So, you know, I'm 60 years old now. I've inhaled lead for most of my life through automobile exhaust. My father smoked, so I inhaled secondhand cigarette smoke. Cigarettes have, they're grown in the soil, so it's tobacco that's grown in the soil. So it basically accumulates all the toxic metals that are in the soil are going to be in the tobacco plant, as they are in a tomato. But when you eat a tomato with lead and mercury and arsenic in it, your liver has natural chelators that can remove that. There are very important chelators in the liver that will detox our food and then excrete the metal through the intestines. You know, one of the things that's missing in Parkinson's disease, one of the thing I should say that is overly used and used up in Parkinson's disease is called glutathione. And glutathione is a very natural chelator antioxidant that must be present in the cell that makes dopamine to neutralize the free radicals that occur with normal metabolism. And we find that in the substantia nigra, or the midbrain of Parkinson's patients, there is a relative absence of glutathione. And so that leaves the cells under distress. So when you eat a tomato, the lead and cadmium and arsenic and nickel that go into the liver, most of that is chelated by the liver cells and removed from the system. But if you inhale it through smoke or through the air or through a cigarette, then you don't have that defense. The lung doesn't have that defense. It's distributed from the lung into the blood, and it's in the and goes directly into bone and muscle, and then it basically stays there for decades. So when I grew up, I inhaled lead. Gas was basically leaded until 1990, so we inhaled lead up to that point on a daily basis, and that's why the lead levels in the 70s in children were very high because of leaded gasoline. That's why gas was unleaded, but the problem with what happens to that lead is it doesn't leave the body. Most of it goes into bone. So bone becomes the major source for lead and mercury. And basically the lead and mercury displaces calcium from the bone and it stays there until something happens to the bone. So it may stay there for decades. And when something happens to the bone, if you break a bone, if you lose the bone because of aging and osteoporosis, if you have surgery on a bone, you're going to release whatever is in that bone into the general circulation, and some of those metals will find access to the central nervous system. So your bone kind of sacrifices itself by attracting these metals, and these metals will displace calcium from the bone, but when something happens to the bone, that's when it transfers to the brain, and that's what happens with aging, because as you age, you start to lose bone, and when you lose bone, the lead and the mercury in the bone gets released and can seed the central nervous system. So researchers in the early 80s, said, well, we want to sample what's in the bone, and we certainly can't biopsy everybody's bone, so why don't we use the method of removing the metals the method approved by the FDA was chelation. So if you have lead poisoning or mercury poisoning, you would chelate that person to remove those heavy metals to try and improve their lot. Well, they said, why don't we chelate somebody? Why don't we give the chelator intravenously and or orally and attract the metal out of the bone and the muscle onto the chelator, and then the liver and kidney will immediately excrete it. So they collected the urine immediately after the chelation, and they found that there was a huge amount of lead and mercury coming out of the body from the removal process. So that was adopted as a method of measurement. Basically, in occupational medicine, someone is in a factory, someone gets high blood pressure and kidney failure, which are known to be caused by lead and mercury, they would be removed from the factory, the levels would be reduced in the blood, but they would still be in the bone and muscle and kidney, so they would chelate that person, then after the chelation, immediately collect the urine for 24 hours and measure how much lead came out. And that became pretty much the standard way of measuring heavy metals, is to measure it after a chelation. And that method of measurement was basically sort of approved by that community in 1988. So for somebody like you and I, we don't work in a factory. I had very little exposure except what was in the environment, but very small amounts of this slowly coming in is going to be attracted into bone. So if I inhaled lead growing up, if I inhaled mercury growing up, certainly I've been exposed to cigarette smoke and to the dust, in my community. If lead and cadmium and nickel, arsenic and aluminum are placed in the environment, which they certainly are, because if you analyze the soil, you find them there. And on a dusty day, I inhale some, not enough to show up as a huge amount in my blood, but most of that metal is attracted into my bone. And so over many years, I slowly accumulate a significant amount of those metals in my bone. And then when something happens to my bone, as I age, if I fracture it, that's when these metals are released into the general circulation. And that particular research has been quite well done by someone named Ellen Silvergeld at Johns Hopkins. She was at the University of Maryland for many, many years. I should give them credit. And now she's at Johns Hopkins, I believe. And she has published some very interesting papers showing how lead, for instance, slowly accumulates from the environment. Small amounts show up in the blood, but most of it is attracted into bone. And then the bone becomes a source for later toxicity of the brain. So there's one particular paper that I found very interesting called Lead in Bone, which was in the Journal for Neurotoxicology in 1993. And she described this mechanism, how lead will slowly biologically accumulate in the bone. And then when something happens to the bone, it'll be released into the central nervous system. And then once lead gets into the central nervous system, once lead gets into your brain, it just creates a tremendous array of toxicity for the neuron. And what specifically, what's fascinating to me is how some patients with fairly high amounts of lead in their bone will selectively attract that into the midbrain and develop Parkinson's disease, and some other patients will selectively attract it into, say, the frontal lobe and develop dementia. And that has somewhat to do with our genetics. There's a lot of genetic links that are appearing with Parkinson's disease and with Alzheimer's disease that might explain why, if you have lead in your bone, for instance, it's attracted into your substantia nigra or your midbrain, and you develop a degeneration of that area of the brain versus someone else who might not even attract it into the brain and never develop dementia, or someone who will attract it into a different area of the brain. There's a lot of plausible explanation as to why that would occur. So, you could see how excited I got once I knew how to measure it, and once I found that, that there was a tremendous amount of literature that showed the proper measurement. So the name of the measurement is called post-provocation. You provoke the metal to come out of the bone and muscle with the chelator. And then after giving the chelator, as the metals start to come out of the bone and muscle and get attracted to the chelator, which is how you would remove the metals if you were poisoned by them with chelation, you do a chelation, and then you collect the urine for 24 hours and have it analyzed, and then you can see a big difference. You can see a tremendous difference in what's in that bone. And that type of measurement called post-provocation is basically termed measuring the body burden for heavy metals. And that's really something that several physician organizations have been studying. There are two major physician organizations, one called the American College for the Advancement of Medicine, ACAM, and the American College for the Integrative Medicine, ISTEM. Those are MD organizations that have studied how to measure this, what doses of the chelator to use safely if these metals are present. And they've kind of led the way into sort of bringing us to this exciting new area of medicine where we actually can measuring some things that contribute to neurodegenerative disorders. Did I lose you?
Not at all. People listening to this conversation may be now thinking, hey, I really ought to get this post-provocation test. And I'm thinking to myself, well, no, I didn't work in a paint factory, but I certainly liked to smell fuel when I was a teenager when it was being put into the car. If I were to go to your clinic, explain for everyone exactly what would happen with this test. Would you give me an IV first, this chelation IV? Or would
yes,
it be
that,
a shot? Or?
Yes, it's an IV. Now, there are milder forms of measurement, but if you don't give enough of the chelator to attract the metal out, you're going to underestimate what we find. So there is an oral chelator that was approved for children in 1990 for lead poisoning and for mercury poisoning or toxicity, and that definition is really under question. You know, what constitutes lead toxicity? Well, the public health department says you should have a certain level of lead in your blood over, say, 60 or 70 micrograms, for instance, but that doesn't hold water. Researchers have shown that even within the so-called reference range for lead, which is 0 to 10 micrograms in your blood, there is significant toxicity, particularly in children. So attention deficit syndrome, learning disabilities, behavioral problems have been found within levels between, say, 3 and 6 micrograms of lead in the blood of a child. So a lot of this work done by Harold Needleman at the University of Pittsburgh originally published a paper in 1979 in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that he could predict classroom behavior and IQ based on how much lead was in the baby teeth, because teeth like bone would attract lead. And he found that, you know, the blood lead levels are unreliable. So basically what you can do in children in particular, is you can give some oral chelating pills for 4 or 5 days based on their body weight and based on an FDA formula for removing lead. And I think at this point the FDA frowns a little bit on chelation. I'm not quite sure why. They certainly approved it for lead toxicity, but I think because the definition of lead toxicity is based on blood lead level, there's a little bit of friction among physicians who chelate and physicians who don't know about chelation, because they're feeling that the doctors are chelating inappropriately because the blood lead level isn't high enough. But the research clearly shows that it's an unreliable marker as to measure it in the blood. So you have to give a significant amount of the chelator to pull out enough metal to then collect the urine to measure it. So the protocols that have been developed by the by the International College of Integrative Medicine and the American College for Advancement of Medicine calls for using around 3 grams of EDTA intravenously, which appears to be extremely safe. You know, the doses that were approved by the FDA are much higher than that, and if you use the very high levels, you can overwhelm the kidney and create problems. But that doesn't seem to occur at 3 grams, and certainly doesn't occur with 1 gram. There are many studies that used chelation in chronic kidney failure patients in the 80s, and sort of decided upon the safe dose to use. So, you know, basically the doses are relatively safe that we use, what I usually like to do is give the oral chelator for 4 days and then do an intravenous EDTA provocation where you give it intravenously, and that starts attracting the metal out. You immediately collect the urine, and I also like to collect the bowel movement because the liver does most of the detoxing, and I find that if I just measure the urine, I'll miss some of the toxic metals that come out of the liver, particularly mercury. Mercury is heavily excreted through the liver into the intestines, and so I like to do collect the urine and a bowel movement and have those analyzed. And it's always a good idea to check the urine and the bowel movement and the blood before chelating so that you'll see that there really isn't anything being excreted. That's called a pre-provocation measurement, and then you chelate, and then you collect the urine and the stool afterwards, and you can see the difference. You can see how much more metal is coming out of the body being attracted out by the chelator. So, yes, the measurement is an intravenous infusion of the chelator and then a collection of the urine, and in my case, the stool. That still hasn't gained favor yet, but I presented some data recently at a conference in Minnesota, called an iMosaic conference. It was a joint conference for all the integrative medicine conferences, and I showed some data how stool measurements are really important for 3 very toxic metals that I find in my Parkinson's and Alzheimer's patients: mercury, bismuth, and tungsten are very neurotoxic metals that I find in practically all of my patients with neurodegenerative disorders. So it is an intravenous infusion and then collection of the specimens. It's the only way to tell, other than biopsying the bone and having it analyzed for several different metals, and that's just not practical. That provocation, you know, in my experience, is very safe to do.
Would your explanation then suggest that our bones and muscles are an exposure source for neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's?
Absolutely. You know, that's, when you think of it, Robert, probably everyone listening knows someone who's probably over 65 who fractured a hip. And this is a good forum to get this point across because I don't think it's considered. But, you know, I know what's in the hip bone now because I've measured it in several thousand people. I know what metals are in the bone. I know that these metals are primarily in bone because bone attracts most of the mineral. So when you fracture a bone, you release this metal into the general circulation. And some of it is going to seed the central nervous system. Some of it is going to be absorbed by the heart. Some of it is going to be absorbed by the kidney. So it's the fracture causes a sudden release. So everyone knows someone who's fractured a hip and died within a 2-year period or went downhill tremendously. You know, pretty close to national statistics across the board. I know certainly in several of the hospitals that I deal with that when you fracture a hip, when you have an older person over 65 who fractures a hip and you follow them over a 2-year period, 50%, half of those people are dead in a 2-year period. And they die from apparently unrelated disorders like heart attack, stroke, dementia, pneumonia, God knows what. but they die nonetheless after a fracture. So there's a tremendous deterioration in health after a bone fracture. We have to ask your question, why? Well, what's in the bone? Well, you can tell what's in the bone with this provocation test. You know, studies have shown, dating back 30 years, that if you do these X-ray techniques that can detect these metals, that you see there's a significant quantity of these heavy metals in bone. So the bone becomes a source for disease later on. There's a very interesting study 2 years ago in the journal called Circulation, which is the American Heart Association's major journal. This was by Howard Hugh, that's H-U, Dr. Howard Hugh's group at Harvard. Dr. Howard Hugh is a major researcher on bone lead and toxicity of other organs. And Dr. Hugh has done several studies for the Veterans Affairs Normative Aging Study. And he's published over 230 research papers on what we're talking about today, on how lead gets absorbed into bone, and then from bone it transfers to other organs, and that bone lead is the major culprit for eventual disease. So Dr. Hugh's group in Boston at Harvard, they did this very special X-ray called K-Shell X-ray fluorescence, which could quantitate the amount of lead in your shin bone. And they took 1,000 veterans from Boston who were relatively healthy at the time. They did this X-ray of the bone to quantitate the lead content of bone. They found, as they would in us, there was no occupational exposures. These were normal citizens. They just grew up in America, grew up during the era of leaded gasoline and paint, lead and paint, et cetera. So they had the same exposures we did. They found that in these 1,000 veterans that they quantitated lead content, some of them had a very high lead content in their shin bones, and some of them had very little. And again, that difference is explainable, why somebody would retain more lead in their bones and somebody else would excrete it. Some people have better excretion potential. Some people have better detoxing potential than others. So if your potential is not that good, you're going to retain more of these metals from the environment in your system. So they took these 1,000 veterans. They compared those who had the highest one-third for lead in their bone, the top tertile, they called it, and they compared them to the bottom one-third. So if you had the highest one-third for lead in your bone compared to those of these 1,000 veterans that had the lowest one-third, they compared those two populations over a 10-year period. And they found that heart attack death rate was 6 times higher in the category of people who had the highest lead amount in their shin bone versus those with the lowest. And there was a 3 to 4 higher cancer death rate in the top tertile for lead versus the lower tertile for lead. So death from all causes were increased depending on the bone lead concentration. Now, that paper was published in the journal Circulation in September of 2009. I haven't heard any reaction to that paper, but that was a huge confirmation into what I thought was going on and what Ellen Silvergeld has said for years, that these metals get sequestered in bone, and then that becomes a source for the other organs. So that makes it easier to explain. So if heart attack and cancer and dementia and neurodegenerative disorders are more likely to occur depending on the heavy metal content of your bone, certainly the bone becomes a source for the other organs. And I thought that research was fascinating.
It is fascinating. Listeners will really know that the hallmark of idiopathic Parkinson's disease is something called the Lewy body. How do metals contribute to Lewy bodies?
Lewy bodies basically define Parkinson's disease as opposed to, say, Parkinson's disorders or Parkinson's syndromes. The Lewy body is a stainable inclusion body or glob of junk in the middle of the cell of the dopamine-producing cells, particularly of dopamine-producing cells with neuromelanin, which is the pigmented cells. Those are usually the cells you lose in Parkinson's disease. The Lewy body, if you analyze it, is normal protein from within the cell that's either been discarded and was being processed for removal, and it also has heavy amounts of iron and aluminum. So the Lewy body, if you analyze a Lewy body, and a Lewy body is found in patients with Parkinson's disease, and particularly it's found in other areas of the brain, in the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe in patients with Parkinson's disease and dementia. And the Lewy body is basically a glob of protein that is a normal constituent from proteins within the cell. These proteins have been defined. One is called the nucinclin, and another is called ubiquitin. These are proteins that are normal structural and functional proteins within the neuron, and somehow they accumulate in the middle of the cell where they're not supposed to be, and protein being negatively charged attracts metals, which are positively charged, just like in a magnetic effect. So anybody that's had a magnet and had some metal filaments and you can see them accumulate to the magnet, that's exactly what the protein does to the metals. So when you analyze a Lewy body, which is the hallmark for Parkinson's disease pathology on autopsy, you find protein, normal proteins from within the structure of the neuron, and you find large amounts of iron, and you find aluminum. And the theory is that the Lewy body, which is discarded protein that isn't properly digested, so when you restructure a neuron, which you have to do all the time, and the same mechanism occurs in Alzheimer's disease, you have protein digestive enzymes within your cells. They're called proteases. And basically these protein digestive enzymes digest the old protein from within your neuron, and then the structural machinery of the cell will make new proteins. In particular, the endoplasmic reticulum and the mitochondria will produce new proteins to restructure your neuron so it stays healthy. So the old protein has to be digested by protein digestive enzymes. But in the case of Parkinson's disease and also in Alzheimer's disease, the discarded protein and the older protein doesn't get digested, so it piles up in the middle of the cell. And then being a negatively charged magnet, so to speak, it starts attracting iron and aluminum, and those metals are highly toxic when they accumulate in large amounts in the cell. And that starts a oxidative syndrome where there's oxidative damage within the cell. So if researchers have infused iron into the substantia nigra or the brainstem of laboratory animals and found that the same lesions that occur in Parkinson's disease occur in those laboratory animals because of the iron infusion. So iron, which is extremely necessary within your cells. Iron is responsible for the mitochondria's ability to make energy, to turn oxygen into energy. But if something displaces that iron and pushes it out of the mitochondria into the cytoplasm, which is the free space within the cell, then it becomes extremely reactive and it will steal an electron from another area within the cell. And that's called oxidative stress. And that's what happens in Parkinson's disease. The cells basically are falling apart because of oxidative stress. And the hallmark of that is to analyze the Lewy body, which is normal discarded protein from within the cell and heavy deposits of iron and deposits of aluminum. And the iron and aluminum start stealing electrons from the other organs within the cell, and then the cell has no defense. And one of the defenses that the cell uses is called glutathione, and basically you use up your glutathione, and so your cell is then defenseless. And when it becomes defenseless, it dies. So the Lewy body is actually, other than aluminum, which shouldn't be in there, is normal constituents within the cell, but the cell's falling apart and those bodies are accumulating within. So researchers have quandared about the iron deposits in the brains of Parkinson's patients and what to do about it. And certainly iron is removable with chelation because iron would be attracted to the chelator. So I'm not sure whether that's some of the reason why I see some clinical response, or whether it's because of the heavier metals such as lead and mercury. You're removing really all of them with the chelator. And there's a very interesting paper by Dr. McLaughlin published using iron chelators in Alzheimer's disease and showing an improvement and reduction of deterioration. What he thought, because iron deposits are also found in the cells, in the cytoplasm, and outside the neurons in Alzheimer's disease. So iron, again, is a very important ingredient in the cells, in the neurons, to help us generate energy. But if iron gets displaced from the mitochondria into another area of the cell, it becomes toxic to the cell. So a Lewy body is normally discarded proteins with the heavy amounts of iron and aluminum.
How do lead and mercury affect the function of the brain?
In numerous ways. There's so much research on their neurotoxicity, it would take us six shows to discuss. I think the first thing they do is they interfere with enzymes. So we mentioned how normal proteins from within the cell should be digested and removed. So a protein digestive enzyme takes a protein which is coupled by several amino acids. So a protein is several amino acids linked together. That's what your genes are. That's what your structural proteins within your cells are. So when you restructure cells, you have to digest the old protein and get rid of it and recycle the amino acids so you can make new ones. So it's very important to have a functioning protein digestive enzyme within your cells. Lead and mercury displace or inhibit enzymatic function. So an enzyme is a protein also. So enzymes function because they have a certain conformation or form. An enzyme, again, is a protein which is negatively charged. And all of our enzymes require minerals, trace minerals, to keep them functional. So, for instance, one of the digestive enzymes that are necessary to digest the proteins within a neuron, protease, requires zinc, which is a metal that holds the protein together in a certain shape. And it's the shape of that protein that allows it to grab the protein that you've discarded and help digest it. And zinc, being a positively charged metal, holds that zinc and copper and manganese. These are metals that hold the protein in its proper form. If you were to displace zinc with another metal, it would change the configuration of that protein, its stoichiometric form, and that would cause it to not be able to grab the substance that it needed to grab. So what we know from research is that lead and mercury displace zinc, and now they take the place of zinc, so that causes the protein to fold in a different form, and then it becomes useless. So one of the ways that lead and mercury disturb neurologic function is that they inhibit normal enzymatic function. That in and of itself would be enough. However, there's many other things that happen. Lead and mercury also displace iron from the mitochondria of the neuron, and iron is extremely important in its functional state in an enzyme called cytochrome C in the mitochondria, and that allows oxygen to come in your cell. Iron steals an electron. Cytochrome C with iron steals an electron from oxygen, and that allows oxygen to release energy to allow the cell to have energy to make its functional energy molecule called adenosine triphosphate. Lead and mercury displace iron from the mitochondria. That was work done by Ellen Silbergeld at the University of Maryland. She showed that lead could disable the mitochondrial enzyme and reduce heme function, which is the energy molecule of your brain. Lead would inhibit that function. Lead also, in and of itself, and mercury cause a disassembly of the internal structure of the neuron. There's something called a microtubule. Your microtubules are tubular protein structures that are support structures for the neuron, and they are tubular structures that go from the body of the neuron through the axon to the end plate, and they help transport neurotransmitters. They help transport nutrients throughout the cell, and your microtubules are held together by a protein called tau, T-A-U protein. It's almost like a little coupling that is soldered in to hold the microtubule together. All this protein structure is assembled by your endoplasmic reticulum, which is an organ of the neuron. Mercury is known to unsolder or uncouple tau protein, so that causes the microtubules to separate and basically fall apart, and that causes the internal structure of the neuron to disassemble. Lead also causes a dysfunction of calcium, and calcium is extremely necessary in the neuron to produce energy. The flux of calcium across cell membranes is extremely important to promote the electrical charge of the neuron. If your neuron can't make its normal electrical charge, it becomes useless, and it can't transport information from your brain into your muscle. So lead inhibits calcium flux and displaces calcium and causes tremendous disruptions in normal electrical potential in the neuron. There's so many different dysfunctions that occur with just lead and mercury alone. Aluminum also embeds itself into the neuron's genes, into the DNA, and causes an irreversible dysfunction of the DNA of the neuron. And many examples of this throughout the history of medicine have been published from 1950 to 1960. There were several thousand cases of neurodegenerative disorder, which they weren't sure what it was. It was tunnel vision blindness, paralysis, ataxia, which is unsteady gait. It was named after the town. It was called Minamata's disease because from 1950 to 1960, there was a terrible epidemic of this neurodegenerative disorder. It was a combination of multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease and Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and many of these patients died. And after about 10 years, finally on autopsy, there were very, very high mercury levels found in these patients. So they tracked down that mercury was being released from a factory that was based on the Minamata River. They were making vinyl chloride, which is a derivative to make plastic, and they were using mercury as a solvent, and they were dumping the mercury into the Minamata River, and then it got into the fish. And once it got into the Minamata Bay, the two surrounding towns got Minamata's disease. And finally, they shut the factory down, and Minamata disorder subsided. But it took almost 10 years of research to figure out it was mercury toxicity. And then, interestingly enough, over the next 10 years, there were sporadic outbreaks of Minamata's disease. There were 6,000 cases in Iraq. There were several cases in South America. So the researchers, now knowing that it was mercury causing that neurologic disorder, flew to those areas and were looking for mercury, and they found that there was a particular wheat seed that a factory, a wheat-producing seed factory, was spraying their wheat with mercury chloride as a fungicide to keep it from getting moldy, so it would have a greater shelf life, much like we do with some of our vaccines. Mercury is a preservative. And the mercury was getting into the seed, and then the people were planting the seed and eating the wheat, and they were developing Minamata's disease. So when they prohibited the use of that particular seed, those epidemics of neurodegenerative disorders disappeared. So that's sort of how we figured out over the many years how toxic mercury is to the brain. And then there's several examples of the same thing with lead, lead toxicity in factory workers. And when you look at the brains of patients who are mercury toxic or lead toxic, you see specific neurologic changes in the brain. For instance, mercury causes degeneration of the cerebellum, causes degeneration of the temporal lobes of the brain. Lead has another specific target. Now, when I test patients with neurodegenerative disorders, they don't have one of these metals, they have several of these metals. I have a chart in front of me now. It was a man who I measured with severe Parkinson's disease in 2006. Now, just as an example, his blood lead level was 1.9 micrograms, which is very little because the average person has up to 10. But when I did the provocation test, he excreted 57 micrograms of lead over a 12-hour period, which is obviously much higher than 1.9. So the provocation showed that the kidney excreted a great deal of lead. Now, there was very little mercury coming out of his 12-hour urine collection, but I collected a stool, and he had 15 milligrams of mercury come out with that one treatment. Now, that is an extremely high level of mercury. If you injected 5 or 6 milligrams of mercury intravenously into a patient, they would die within a few hours. And, you know, we removed 15 milligrams safely on a chelator because it's the chelator binds it and doesn't allow it to be released into the other tissues. So, you know, basically, the research on aluminum, on mercury, on lead, its neurotoxicity. Joel Pounds is a researcher who's done most of the lead toxicity. Ellen Silbergeld has published, you know, many, many papers on the neurotoxicity of lead. The one of the mercury gurus in this country, Tom Clarkson at the University of Rochester, he's shown how mercury affects all levels of neurologic function, all levels of neuron function. You know, it's just the evidence is overwhelming. And it's interesting how some people are sensitive to these metals and others have an ability to resist them. May I give you an example of that?
Oh, please do.
There was an epidemic of something called Pink's disease in the 1950s. This was a disorder of infants where their extremities would become extremely pink and then they would get extreme pain. And then in some cases they would actually lose the digits. And it was a horrible sort of mini epidemic. And the pediatricians in the 50s discovered that it was due to a teething powder called calomel. And calomel was a teething powder that was used pretty commonly in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and it was mercury chloride. And they found that the mercury chloride was being absorbed, and it was getting into the extremities and the peripheral nerves and creating a peripheral neuropathy in these children, and they were getting extraordinarily ill. So they prohibited the use of calomel as teething powder. And then that epidemic seemed to wane. Then in 1970, there was another epidemic of Pink's disease, and there were some 960 reported cases over several months of this horrible disease called Pink's disease, which is also medically called acrodynia, acro meaning periphery and dynia meaning pain. So it was a very painful disease of the extremities of these children, and they'd get this pink discoloration of their hands. So now the researchers know what to look for. So they searched for a source of mercury because they found very high mercuries in these children who had Pink's disease. And they found that it was a diaper company that was using mercury chloride and spraying the diapers with mercury chloride with the idea that mercury chloride is a commonly used fungicide. And that, you know, it's used in industry, it's used to spray on crops to basically stop it from getting moldy and degenerating from fungi. And this diaper company was spraying the diaper with mercury chloride. And so Tom Clarkson was asked to investigate this from University of Rochester. And Dr. Clarkson showed some extraordinary findings. He saw that 960-some-odd children had this severe disorder from Pink's disease from using these diapers. But well over 10,000 infants were regularly using these diapers. And he said it's extraordinary that only 10% of the children got obviously clinically sick from using the same source of mercury. So some of us have an increased sensitivity to getting sick from these metals, and other of us are lucky enough to be able to either handle them better, neutralize them by our natural defenses, or properly excrete them. So I thought that that was an extraordinary revelation, how 10,000 children were exposed to these diapers on a regular basis, but only 900 actually got sick from it. And I think that's what makes this so difficult for the medical community to understand. We all have lead in our bone. We all have mercury in our bone. There's no question about that. But why do some get sick from it and others don't seem to get sick, and some get sick in different ways? And it's very difficult for the medical community to grasp that, for instance, this particular metal, if it's present, is going to be causing the disease in everyone. Very interesting study from Baylor in the 90s. They found that patients with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, seemed to be people who were exposed to welding and people who were farmers who worked a lot of fertilizer. So if you work with fertilizer, you're guaranteed to be working with heavy metals that the cow tried to excrete through his liver. So, you know, we use this fertilizer to nourish our crops, but it's the excretion product of an animal who knew better to get rid of these metals. So when a cow eats lead, his liver will chelate it and excrete it through his manure. And then we're putting the manure around our plants, and so we're exposing the plants to the excretion product of an animal that knew how to excrete it. So the animal has all these defense mechanisms also. So farmers, for that reason, have higher incidences of neurologic disorders and Parkinson's disorder. Parkinson's is much higher in farmers than in non-farmers, and so is Lou Gehrig's disease. So someone, and some other research showed that trauma, muscle trauma, or heavy physical labor with muscle breakdown, seemed to incite the onset of Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. So someone at Baylor had the bright idea to biopsy the muscles of patients with neurodegenerative disorders, and they wanted to see if patients with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease had higher quantities of lead and mercury in their muscles than, say, somebody with Parkinson's disease. But lo and behold, they saw that the muscle biopsies of patients with all neurodegenerative disorders demonstrated the presence of aluminum, cadmium, mercury, lead, and arsenic, which are all neurotoxic. So they kind of dropped the ball and said, well, you know, we were looking for, there's a vast amount of literature showing that if you have an injury, if you have trauma, if you get injured in a car accident or even have major surgery, which is a traumatic event, then there seems to be an increased risk of Lou Gehrig's disease. And they wanted to prove that maybe these people have accumulated heavy amounts of lead and mercury in their muscles, and when you break down the muscle with the trauma, it gets released into the brain and spinal cord. But what they found was interesting to me, that most, if not all, the patients with several different neurodegenerative disorders, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis, and Parkinson's disease, have heavy metals in their muscle tissue. So again, that becomes a source, doesn't it? But how it affects us seems to be somewhat genetic. You know, there might be some genetic, and many of the genetics are being worked out now. Many of the genetics may predispose you to one disease over another. So just to discount the fact that, okay, these metals are present in the muscle, but they're not predominantly present in one particular disease, I think what we have to understand is we all handle these metals in different ways, and they're all attracted possibly into different areas of the brain based on our genetics. So I found that all this research is out there, and it's very little is known about what has been researched. But once I learned how to measure what was in somebody, once I learned how to properly measure the heavy metals in somebody, I was able to then find these references just out of my curiosity and see all this vast amount of research that's been done on neurologic disorders. Now, it's interesting to me that I have not found any research that analyzed the substantia nigra or the basal ganglion midbrain of patients with Parkinson's disease for lead and mercury. That has been done for Alzheimer's disease. So when you examine the brains of Alzheimer's patients and analyze them with microprobe analysis, which is a special technique to look at the mineral content of the brains, you find definite presence of aluminum, lead, and mercury in those brains. But I haven't that particular evaluation has been done in Parkinson's disease for aluminum and iron and for other trace metals, but I haven't seen any literature at all analyzing the brain specifically for lead or mercury. So hopefully this will stir some interest in that. You know, our conversation has got to stir some interest, whether it's negative or positive.
My guest today is Dr. Joe Hickey from the Hickey Wellness Center in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. By way of summary, Dr. Hickey, it sounds like you're saying that bone loss, orthopedic surgery, or even bone trauma can contribute to neurological dysfunction. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, Robert. You know, in particular, when I see a young patient with it, I, for instance, have a 33-year-old man who has Parkinson's disease, and now that I measure his toxic metal level, he had very high levels of mercury and lead only after the provocation, not in the blood. So when you now know the presence of what's in the body, you don't expect a young man to be losing bone. You ask him, well, what's happened to you? And lo and behold, I usually get a history that he had a fracture. He was in a car accident. He broke his leg about a year or two before the onset of his symptoms. I find that that if you're a younger person who develops early onset of disease, and of course, if the metals are present after the proper measurement, then some type of trauma to bone or fracture to bone is usually found in the history. Very interesting study from Duke University, Terry Monk, who's in the anesthesia department, because we're having a problem with cognitive dysfunction post-surgical. That was quite obvious after bypass surgery, where patients would have bypass surgery and end up with a significant amount of dementia within a 2 or 3 year period. And there are a lot of theories as to why that when you have bypass surgery, you have to go on a heart-lung machine, your blood pressure drops, they have to slow the heart down. So there's a lot of stuff going on there that maybe could contribute to lack of circulation to the brain and death of neurons. But that's not the case with orthopedic surgery. So we're seeing the same thing happening with orthopedic surgery, particularly with hip replacement. So Dr. Monk's group did a very intricate cognitive testing prior to total hip replacement and measured all parameters of thinking, calculation ability, memory. And then after the surgery, before they left the hospital, they repeated those tests and saw that a good 30% of the people had a significant drop in their cognitive function before the discharge from the hospital. Now, of course, they're used anesthesia, they used several narcotic drugs, so you've got to take that into consideration. So they looked at those people 3 months later, and they saw even more of those people, up to 40%, had a significant reduction in cognitive function. And then when they looked at them over 2 years, it was up to 48%. So, you know, that's a big concern, and the idea is, what happened there? There was no significant drop in blood pressure. Certainly the effects of anesthesia were well gone by that time. What is the issue here? And my feeling is it's because of what was in the bone. You know, what was in the bone to cause the arthritic process in the first place, you know, lead, for instance, gets into bone, it displaces calcium. You need calcium to repair your bone. Calcium stimulates the cell that allows the bone to regenerate. The bone cell that regenerates bone after you use it, after you break it down with exercise and with gravity's effect on it, is called the osteoblast. And the osteoblast will repair the broken bone, and it needs calcium as a stimulant. But lead inhibits the osteoblast, so it causes the bone to break down and it can't repair itself. And that's why our bone falls apart eventually. But, you know, when you operate on that bone, you're cutting through it. You're releasing it into the general circulation. And some of that, as Dr. Silbergeld has taught us, will enter the central nervous system. And when lead enters the central nervous system, all bets are off as to whether or not that neuron's going to function properly or not. So, you know, basically, even surgical trauma is a potential precipitating event to cognitive or neurologic dysfunction, yes.
Listeners are going to be interested in contacting you for appointments, Dr. Hickey. How do they get in touch with you?
Well, I have a website, Hickey Wellness Center. My phone number is 843-842-9960. I think, you know, not to toot my own horn, if you get on the website for the International College of Integrative Medicine or the American College for the Advancement of Medicine, that's ISAM and ACAM, you can find physicians who were properly trained in these chelation techniques and who have, you know, studied and passed certification tests by those organizations. You may be able to find somebody in your neighborhood if you get on those websites. Not that I wouldn't love to see you, but, you know, certainly traveling over great distances may be a problem. So, you know, there certainly is a doctor in your area who might know some of the stuff that I'm talking about today. Now, obviously, I'm a little bit of a maniac in my research. I love this stuff. I love to research the effects of these metals. So I've sort of gone over the top with it. But, you know, I just find it's, at this age, a fascinating new way of looking at my patients. But, you know, certainly they can give me a call, but also they could get on the websites of those particular organizations and probably find a doctor who's knowledgeable in these techniques.
The website is www.drjosephhickey.com. So that's D-R and then the word Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, and then Hickey, H-I-C-K-E-Y.com. And Dr. Hickey's clinic is in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Dr. Hickey, what will it take to get this research out there for proper controlled trials?
People like you, what you're doing, you know, what you're doing for the public, you know, you are a guiding light. You're a light in a dark room. You know, this is the kind of forum that I've never had. There's no way to stir the medical community in this direction unless there's patient demand. It's just, I don't know why that is. I know that the research is done. Most of the research is done by PhDs, by brilliant researchers at major institutions. But the information just doesn't seem to be passed down. For instance, how did I not know how to properly measure heavy metals for 20 years of my practice? It just isn't on the radar. The fact that we have all this biological accumulation in our bones and it's not on the medical radar yet, it's mind-boggling. And I don't think there's a conspiracy, you know, against people getting well. I didn't know any of this research. I had no need to know it because I never really needed to apply it, or so I thought, because I measured it improperly. So the only way to, I mean, think of Dr. Howard Hughes' study in circulation showing that a major predictor of heart attack and cancer death was how much lead was in your shin bone. I mean, that should shock us, and that should be on Fox News, that should be on CNN, and it wasn't. So I think it's just a matter of awareness. You know, I certainly was not aware of any of this research. You know, I sort of stumbled upon how to measure it properly, but I was open to it. I must say that I didn't regard chelation very high prior to seeing it work. You know, in my ignorance, because I had never done it. Most doctors who criticize it or say that it's dangerous, they've never done it. They've never, ever chelated a patient, nor have they ever found an elevated level of metal with the proper measurement. So I think it's a little bit of ignorance. It's also different than what we're doing. You know, basically, right now, we're kind of in a funk. We're in a mental funk of prescription medication. You know, all the research that's being paid for is basically whether one drug is better than placebo. I applied at least 3 or 4 years in a row to the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Did not get considered until recently. Last year, I got a lot of consideration. I was in the final stages for possibly a research grant. What I wanted to do at that time is I wanted to have a double-blind placebo-controlled trial where I would chelate one group and give placebo chelation to another and have independent neurologists do testing on the Parkinson's patients once a month, and then they wouldn't know who was treated, and so they would independently score these patients to see if they were improving, not improving. And the PhD, who was sort of assistant in charge of the research, was very excited about this possibility. And we already had recruited some patients. But when the final analysis came, when the decision of who to give the money to, it usually is turned over to the MDs. They got very critical of the chelation process, and they ended up giving a substantial grant to a pharmaceutical company. Now, I understand that. I understand that we're looking for the magic bullet, but we haven't found it. And, you know, we haven't found it. It's about time we looked for cause. And when you think of it, Robert, we're not looking for cause. You know, when someone gets sick, basically looking for the cause of that illness is not our first priority. It's diagnosing it and categorizing it. So if you've got Parkinson's disease versus you've got, you know, progressive supranuclear palsy, or you've got multiple sclerosis, that actually has become the job of the neurologist or the physician. Now that we've made the diagnosis, we have treatment plans, which will consist of, you know, various medications to relieve the symptoms. But we're not looking at cause. We're not looking at, well, I wonder if, for instance, we know that certain herbicides or pesticides like paraquat can be associated with increased incidence of Parkinson's disease. We know that certain environmental toxins, in particular that toxin MPPP, which is derivative of a narcotic that was made, will create Parkinson's disease if it's inhaled or injected. We know that environmental issues have caused Parkinson's disease. So, but our paradigm, our focus is really in medicine not to look for that. And I can't really explain that. I just think it's a paradigm we're in right now. You know, for instance, who would think of checking the lead content of the shin bone to prevent a heart attack? But Dr. Hughes showed a high correlation. So this is the direction we have to start, you know, sort of pushing ourselves into. And the only way it's going to happen is with public awareness. It's going to be demand. And, you know, I think the days are numbered where we just sort of line up and say, okay, I've got this disease, these are the pills I'm going to take for it, and then all I can hope for is maybe a slower degeneration or progression of my disease. I think the time is ripe for us to say, well, why can't we look for the cause of this? Why can't we look for, because there isn't one cause. There's a combination of things, I'm quite sure. It isn't just lead and mercury, but they certainly contribute. If they didn't, why would people improve when you removed it? But I don't think it's the major. It's not the only cause. You have to have a certain genetics, and the genetics is kind of being worked out. You have to have in certain environmental exposures. You have to have release of those environmental exposures into the brain. A lot of things have to come together. But I know that in my own case, applying this research has really wreaked some tremendous benefits. for instance, one of my patients fractures a hip, and I watch them closely, and they start becoming demented and having trouble putting words together. If I measure the metals, find the neurotoxic metals in them, and remove them, I can see reversal of that. So I think the idea that these toxins are in the body, that they're predominantly in the bone, and when something happens to the bone, it transfers to the brain, I think that should be fairly well accepted by the medical community, but it's not quite on the radar yet. So the only way for it to get on the radar is for us to talk about it.
Dr. Joe Hickey, on behalf of the many, many people who have listened to this show live and the many more people who will actually be listening over the coming weeks and months, I want to thank you for this most illuminating and informative discussion.
Well, it was fun, Robert. I think if I didn't talk to somebody about it, I would burst.
I'm telling you, there are many, many people who are listening, and I think you will discover here in the coming months that you've had a profound impact on many, many individuals. So thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show today.
I thank you also, Robert.
And that's what's happening on the shores of the Puget Sound, where all the women are smart, all the men are handsome, and all the children are truly loved. Know that by virtue of the fact you are listening to this show, that you are on the road to recovery.